You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of April, 2013, right here on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24. We're live from Studio One in London with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we head to Hong Kong to set the day's agenda with the big stories you'll need to know. Aisha, what do you have for us?
We're going to be talking about the bird flu. Does Hong Kong have anything to worry about? The issue of universal suffrage, and then also the expansion of Jetstar into the region.
That's coming up. Also, French troops are in the midst of one of their last offensives in Mali, ahead of the planned withdrawal, but is victory secure?
We also look at an Australian brand that used to be iconic, but that has gone severely downhill, at least when it comes to share prices. What could still rescue the surfwear brand Billabong?
You know, the whole thing about wearing surf brand is to be cool in a way. I mean, I think that whole surf market has changed now to the point where the cool surfers in Australia are starting their own fashion labels because they don't want to wear a logo.
We also look at countries that have managed to protect their architectural heritage. Some are better at it than others. Austria is top of the class. Russia, not so much.
This building was delisted 3 years ago for the interest of some private developers. What they're trying to do, they're trying to build a new building here. So this is a kind of renovation when original building just ceases away.
All that, plus we'll play some great music as well, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
Now that all sounds like a lot of fun, doesn't it? All coming up in the next 59 minutes. I wouldn't go anywhere at all. Barney Berlin's going to kick us off with the world news headlines.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. In the latest escalation of warnings from Pyongyang, North Korea has warned foreigners in South Korea to take evacuation measures in case of war. Quoting the spokesperson for its Korea-Asia-Pacific Peace Committee, the KCNA news agency said, "We do not wish harm on foreigners in South Korea should there be a war." Japan has deployed Patriot missile launches in central Tokyo in a move officials said was aimed at providing ballistic missile defense in the event of a possible North Korean missile launch. In the dead of night, military personnel rolled out two Patriot Advanced Capability 3 interceptors at the Japanese Defense Ministry's headquarters in central Tokyo. Others were deployed to the outskirts of the capital, while TV pictures also appeared to show two launchers ready for action near a US military base in Yokosuka. In another development, South Korea's largest news agency is reporting that North Korean labourers did not report to work at the Kaesong Industrial Park early today. A South Korean government official could not immediately confirm the Yonhap report and said authorities were investigating. The Kaesong complex employs more than 50,000 North Koreans and is one of the North's few sources of ready cash. On Monday, Pyongyang said it would withdraw workers from the industrial park and suspend operations indefinitely. South Korean businessmen operating firms in Kaesong say they're hoping to send a private delegation to Pyongyang to negotiate the issue. The U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has held talks with the Israeli President Shimon Peres in Jerusalem. They discussed the stalled peace negotiations with the Palestinian Authority and the threat that Iran poses to the region. Mr. Kerry gave his assurances that the U.S. is right behind Israel in the face of the Iranian threat.
You have a friend in President Obama. You have friends in this administration, in the Congress, and in America. We understand the nature of the threat of Iran. And as the president has said many times, he doesn't bluff. He is serious. We will stand with Israel against this threat and with the rest of the world, who have underscored that all we are looking for is Iran to live up to its international obligations.
Tributes are continuing to pour in for the former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, who died on Monday. News of her death featured prominently on the flagship newscasts of American broadcasters on Monday evening. On NewsHour, the evening bulletin for the public broadcaster PBS, two former secretaries of state shared their memories of Britain's first woman Prime Minister, who was a staunch ally of both President Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. James Baker said her endorsement of the former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev had helped pave the way for the end of the Cold War. George Shultz remembered being handbagged after a big Reagan-Gorbachev meeting had discussed the possibility of a world free of nuclear weapons. President Obama has urged Americans to pile pressure on Congress to approve new gun control legislation that's at risk of falling victim to Washington gridlock. He took his gun control argument to the University of Hartford in Connecticut. It's an hour's drive from the town of Newtown, where 20 children and six educators were shot dead in December in a massacre that shocked Americans and spurred a fresh movement to tighten gun regulations. The president said politicians must take heed of public opinion.
If our democracy is working the way it's supposed to, and 90% of the American people agree on something, in the wake of a tragedy, you'd think this would not be a heavy lift. And yet some folks back in Washington are already floating the idea that they may use political stunts to prevent votes on any of these reforms. Think about that.
A scathing letter from John Lennon to Paul McCartney, a desperate letter from Marilyn Monroe, and a photo album from Mussolini to Hitler are among the items to be sold next month by a New York auction house. Lennon's letter, a draft which was never sent, is expected to sell for between $10,000 and $15,000. Joe Maddalena, president and owner of Profiles in History, says today's world of modern communications is making letters more and more valuable.
People say, why do people collect letters? Because today everything is electronic. Everything is a message or a text. So what's going to be saved? A chip? What are you going to collect? You know, a hard drive? So, I mean, people are realizing that letters, if you want to understand somebody's thought process or know somebody, read their written word, you know, and it's the best record you're ever going to get. You don't have to guess. Read what they said.
Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. I kind of wish I saved my childhood letters.
Do you?
No, you don't.
Do you? Do you think they could be making some money for
They'd be very embarrassing.
To my pen pals overseas.
Oh, yeah, that could have really bagged you something at Christie's. What do you think the letters from McCartney to Lennon... It was Lennon to McCartney?
Yes, it was after the Beatles broke up and he was telling McCartney to get off his high horse about Yoko Ono, and he said, look, we were just part of the movement, we weren't the movement.
Wow. P.S. Stop writing such sickly melodies and take more acid.
Thank you very much, Barney. Barney will be back in about 23 minutes with another check of the latest world news. It is a 16:07 in Tokyo, 8:07 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
And we're going to kickstart today's programme by setting the day's agenda. This is the part of the show where we take a first look at some of the stories that are likely to feature on the M24 radar throughout the rest of the day.
And joining us now on the line is our Hong Kong Bureau Chief, Aisha Spears, with the three big stories we need to know today. Thanks very much for joining us, Aisha, on the programme. A lot of people talking about that dreaded bird flu. Have you put down your chicken wings?
I have actually put down my chicken wings. Maybe I sound silly, but I'm a little bit sceptical. I'm going to lay off chicken until we know everything's okay. But yeah, sadly, the local headlines are reporting about the H7N9, very catchily named avian flu. Of course, after the bird flu of 97 and SARS of 2003, Hong Kong is particularly sensitive to any sort of threat like this. The virus hasn't come to Hong Kong. There have been no reported cases here yet. It's killed 7 people and made about 24 people sick, reportedly, all in Eastern China, which has led to Shanghai banning trade in live poultry, and they've shut down markets there. The Hong Kong authorities, of course, are being pretty strict about this. I think they're starting inspections of poultry coming in on Thursday, and they've said that they will not hold back in destroying anything that they deem as suspicious in any way.
Given, as you've said, people report or rather respond to this sort of thing fairly sort of with extreme caution and nervousness by the sounds of things, is there a question over how it's reported? Is the media encouraged to take care in the way it talks about the spectre of bird flu?
I assume so, but I think the main scepticism here is that people don't think that China are really giving the real numbers. So a lot of people I've spoken to here have said, well, you know, multiply that perhaps by 5 or 10, the numbers that are being reported. And in fact, that's actually the numbers that are the real numbers in China. So Hong Kong's a little bit concerned about that. But no, the papers are full of news of it. So no one's worried about fear mongering here. The fear is clearly being mongered.
And at the moment, it looks like this is all being it's not human to human transmission. by any stretch of the imagination yet. Are the precautions, though, at airports and ferry ports, are they being stepped up? Are there posters being put up at these kind of transport locations to warn people about the dangers of bird flu?
Nothing as yet, because nothing's been reported in Hong Kong, and I think that probably would scare a lot of people. I haven't noticed more people walking around with face masks. You know, we're not the level of hygiene here is quite high because of what's happened before in the past. So nothing to the kind of average person would you notice that anything's very different. But I think that may change if we get cases coming across the border.
Let's talk about the Occupy Central movement, which is appealing for universal suffrage. How much coverage is that whole issue getting in Hong Kong at the moment?
That seems to be everywhere in Hong Kong at the moment, and I'm trying to work out why exactly. I mean, the real big date will be the 2017, the next time that a chief executive is elected here. So the issue is that it's about the right of the populace to elect the Hong Kong chief executive who represents Hong Kong in Beijing, and it's a delicate issue because Beijing have said, and they responded to this Occupy Central movement over the weekend, saying that you have to have a pro-Beijing, a pro-one-party state representative from Hong Kong to work with Beijing. And there's a professor at the University of Hong Kong here called Benny Tai, who is leading this movement called Occupy Central. It's a very polite movement. So what he said is that in 18 months' time, there will be demonstrations in Central, which is the finance and kind of shopping and commerce district, the central area of Hong Kong where all this takes place. So that he's given everyone a lot of warning, which I don't think you'd see in New York or in London. But it's just to say that there should be voting and the people should be able to vote who represent them in Beijing.
And Aisha, what do you think is behind that 18-month gap in terms of that forward planning? Is it to allow authorities in Beijing time to come up with some kind of a strategy?
Well, the authorities have already responded, saying that they won't even consider electoral reform unless the Hong Kongers agree that the person who goes to Beijing to represent Hong Kong has to be kind of pro the one-party state. And a lot of people have said that makes sense. The former chief secretary, Anson Chan, has said that, you know, if you're going to play this delicate balance that Beijing has with Hong Kong, you have to have someone there who's willing to understand how it works in the one-party state. But Benny Tai is saying that regardless of what actually comes out in 2017, that the main focus is on raising this issue of democracy in Hong Kong. Currently, the chief executive is only voted in by 1,200 people, and those 1,200 people are leaders in the professional field. It's not a kind of a normal guy on the street having any say.
They're clearly very politically sensitive. Clearly, China, not a massive fan of civil disobedience, however organised or not it may be. Let's quickly move on to another story you have highlighted as one of your agenda setters for today, and that's about Qantas and its relationship with Hong Kong in the region.
Indeed. So it looks like Qantas will get approval to start the Hong Kong branch of their budget carrier Jetstar by the end of the year. It was originally planned for the summer, but Jetstar have said that all sorts of kind of red tape and bureaucracy have prevented that. And it would be the first budget airline in Hong Kong. Jetstar obviously already operate an impressive business out of Singapore and also in Japan. It was launched in 2004 and they're the largest low-cost carrier in the APAC region. So for them to get to Hong Kong would be a big deal for them. It would help Qantas, who, as we know, have had some problems recently. And the aim is to increase flights on a budget level between Hong Kong and secondary cities in China.
And is that something that mainland Chinese residents are keen for? Are they looking to shift their modes of transport from rail or road to short-haul air travel?
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, Air China at the moment has the lead on that, and because they've been there's this delay has happened between when Jetstar was supposed to have the license to do it. Air China have a little bit of a heads up. So, but there's a lot of mainland custom coming into Hong Kong, so I don't think there's any problem with the demand there.
Thanks very much. That was Aisha Spears setting the agenda for us from our Hong Kong bureau.
Coming up, we're going to head to Mali to ask what French troops might leave behind when they withdraw.
The Review is Monocle 24's weekly review and preview of the arts. Every Saturday, we take a relaxed look back at the books, TV shows, films, music, theatre and events that have made our week, while looking around the corner to scout out the next big thing.
It doesn't feel sappy, it doesn't feel sentimental. It does have a certain heft. It's very Darwinian. The shows that do well run and the ones that don't close. And there have been some quite high-profile flops and some great successes as well.
For me, it's riotous, it's tasteless, but it's actually dynamic as well. It has momentum.
Join Monocle's editors as they sit down with our favourite critics, opinion makers and key industry figures for some in-depth discussion and lively debate. And we provide inspiration for the weekend from cities around the world.
It's a real divider because I know some people just love this film and other people really just hate it.
That's A Review, every Saturday at midday London time and across the weekend, right here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back. It is 15 in Singapore, 8:15 here in London on a bit of a drizzly, cold and wet spring day. You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn and Dominic Reynolds.
Now, French forces have launched possibly their last big operation in Mali before leaving the country, Operation Gustave. More than 1,000 troops are involved in a mass offensive near the city of Gao to root out Islamists believed to be using the area as a base. Troops will search a 20-kilometre zone with the help of local soldiers and police. There are roughly 4,000 French troops deployed to the North African country.
French forces first headed to Mali in January and have been instrumental in the fight against insurgents, but they will slowly be withdrawing in the coming weeks. By the end of the year, it's expected there will be no more than 1,000 French troops. The operation has largely been viewed as a success so far, but the conflict is still a long way off from being over. So if French troops leave as planned, what sort of country will they leave behind? Well, joining us now is Monocle's contributor in Bamako, Alex Duval-Smith, joining us on the line. Thanks very much for joining us here on Midori House, Alex.
Thanks.
So this is, people are saying this is the last big offensive by French troops in the region. Do we know exactly what they're targeting and how that operation is going so far?
Well, we know that the French are saying this is their last great operation in Mali, and we also know that the French have had an extremely effective publicity machine. They've been fortunate enough to be fighting a war with very few witnesses and no one to give the other side of the story. That having been said, their operation Serval has been very, very impressive, it seems, from those journalists who've been embedded with them. This latest operation is being promoted as one big last push. But I think it's worth bearing in mind the way in which the operation, which is only actually 4 months old, it began in January, has proceeded. And that's that France came in January when the army of Mali became incapable of defending the country, and it became clear that the Islamists were actually going to take the capital, Bamako, where I am, if they were allowed to continue marching southwards. So the French intervened and very quickly swept the country. In 2 weeks, essentially, cities like Timbuktu and Gao were liberated, and France then concentrated its fighting in the very far north, in the Ifoukas mountain range, which is on the border with Algeria. So now we find the French coming south again. And why are they coming south again to Gao? Well, that's most likely because actually the first time around, they didn't get rid of all the enemy.
Well, that being the case then, I guess it leads on to the question of, you know, so far France laid out a plan saying this will be a short intervention to sort of quell any concern back home. And so the plan is then only 1,000 of its troops will remain in Mali. Given that, as you say, that troops are coming back to areas which previously have been declared sort of finished with from the French forces' point of view, is that the plan as it stands realistic?
Well, I think France may well go ahead with that plan, but that plan worries people in Mali a lot. If France were to leave today, it would still leave a country unable to defend itself, a country which still has not received the UN mandate for the deployment of a UN force, which is being promised by French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius, who's organising the resolution for the UN Security Council, a country which is essentially has a very weak and divided army, where it's essentially three soldiers to a rifle and obsolete equipment. So the European Union has arrived and has begun a training mission for 2,000 of those Malian troops. And the United Nations resolution is being prepared for the end of April, after which the West African force that exists, that is here but isn't really showing very much evidence of its existence, is going to be transformed into a Blue Helmet force under a UN mandate. A much clearer mandate than it has at the moment. And then possibly Mali will be a bit closer to being able to defend itself. But France has already revised its troop withdrawal plan. Initially, it was just, we're leaving in July. Now it's, we'll halve our troop numbers by the end of July, from 4,000 to 2,000, leaving 1,000 by the end of the year. And that 1,000 are going to become an anti-terrorist force who are going to function alongside the UN Blue Helmets, who are essentially just a patrolling force. So, you know, plans have been revised. France's initial promise to sort of be in a few months has had to be revised a little bit. But Malians are still very worried that France is going to leave too soon.
And Alex, just very quickly, once the French forces leave and things are left to the Malians, is there a worry, though, that many of these Islamist fighters who have been hiding out in, you know, mud huts or urban areas, that they may suddenly reemerge?
Well, that's precisely what these recent attacks in Gao and Timbuktu are telling us. And that was exactly the fear that happened. When France intervened in January, essentially in the space of 2 weeks, the whole country, the whole populated part of the country was free of Islamists, was declared free of Islamists, and France was able to concentrate fighting in the north. In the last 2 weeks, since Easter really, we've seen suicide bombings and attacks happening in Timbuktu and Gao. And I think that's what explains the launch of this new operation in just north of Gao. Essentially, the French are having to come back and have another go at rooting out the Islamist fighters who, as you say, and in not in all cases, but in some cases, are part of the population and are able to reemerge from the houses and huts and relaunch their offensive in a more using urban guerrilla tactics.
Alex, we will come back to you, I'm sure, as we monitor how that withdrawal process continues. But for now, thank you very much, Alex Duval Smith, Monocle's contributor in Bamako. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
8:22 a.m. here in London. Now, Billabong used to be one of the most successful Australian brands worldwide, but it, like so many other companies, has been hit by the poor retail climate and also by discounting department stores.
Well, the surf company, made famous by its trademark logo on rash vests and boardies, has been struggling so much of late that it's finding a hard time to get anyone to pay anything close to what was initially hoped. The company had a market value of $5 billion as of 2007, but now, according to reports, Billabong chairman Ian Pollard has been considering an offer that values the company only at $300 million.
So what can be done to drag the company out of the deep and worrying waters and back to the shallows of its former glories? Well, a bit earlier, Monocle's resident Australian, of course, who else? Adrian Craddock looked for answers with two other fellow Australians. Wow. Emily Smith, Monocle's PR manager, and branding expert Claire Aitken from Monocle's sister company, Wink Creative. And first of all, it was time to go down memory lane.
I had one of their sort of little canvas, I think they were canvas or maybe sort of polypropylene or something, but their wallets that I asked for Christmas, but they had this sort of big wide strip of Velcro down one side, so they made this amazing sort of sound when you opened it to pull out your 20 cents for a...
I think they still
still so strong.
Yeah, yeah. They were very popular.
I think my little brother still uses one of those, and he's 30.
Vintage.
What about you, Emily? What do you have?
I think I had a singlet when I was about 6 or 7, and I remember the car ride back from the beach with wearing my singlet with like a pink milk, like a strawberry milk. That was a fairly sort of sweet Australian experience.
It definitely conjures that. And, you know, it's a very Australian brand, especially that beach culture. Like, I remember walking around rural Western Australia wearing my Billabong boardies. So we're here talking because Billabong is just about to be sold. Maybe not for a price that they're too happy with. I mean, 5 years ago, they were a $5 billion company, and now there's talk of them being sold for around about $300 million. Where do you think it all went wrong, Claire? I mean, as far as a brand perspective goes, where do you think, you know, they've faltered?
I think they sort of, from a business point of view, before the brand side of things, I think they sort of expanded too far and far too fast at a really unfortunate economic moment. I think in 2010 they had something like 700 stores worldwide, and that was kind of a massive increase from where they'd been a few years before that. So I think they sort of diluted the brand because they were just doing too much.
That's a lot of colourful swimming shorts for anyone. I mean, as popular as they were, 700 stores around the world.
Yeah, but I think as well as that being kind of a business issue, I think it did become a brand issue because, for me, central to Billabong and most surf brands is this kind of idea of the counterculture. And I think when they were visible on every single high street in every single airport right around the world, I think they lost that, you know, that element of sort of non-conformity that makes surf brands cool.
Hmm.
I agree. They totally lost their market. They, you know, the whole thing about wearing surf brand is to be cool in a way. And I think that whole surf market has changed now to the point where surfers, the cool surfers in Australia are starting their own fashion labels because they don't want to wear a logo or they don't want to be owned by a corporation. So the people that have ended up wearing Billabong now, I mean, people you see in the store, it's always tourists in an airport or it's, you know, even tourists in New York in the New York store or wherever. It's never actual surfers, and it's lost its message.
And especially when you look at kind of Billabong's brand origins, you know, they were started like that, you know, in the early 70s, you know, a real kind of back shed operation. And I guess that was supposed to be really central to their brand image, but in some way it's been lost.
Yeah, it's totally been lost. And you read the story of the owners, and he's a surfboard shaper. That's his background. Him and his wife started it. And, you know, it's completely lost anything authentic. And I mean, I guess that's a challenge for any brand. But I think the surf brand in particular, it's just like Uggs or, you know, I know all of them, Quiksilver, they've all had real issue hanging on to what's the core of their brand and how to, like, communicate it.
Yeah. I think also as well, because Billabong, like you're saying, you know, Gordon Merchant was a surfboard shaper, and I don't think people really necessarily relate to, you know, to the brand anymore as an actual surf equipment brand. It's become much more of a fashion and lifestyle brand. It's become a lot, you know, a lot more of a sort of soft and diffuse and kind of feminine offer in a way. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, they haven't really focused particularly much on that core element, which is surfing, which is a love of, you know, of the sport, of being close to nature, of sticking it to the man. I think they've sort of become the man.
I agree. It's not fashion. It's not surf. And it's not quick to market high street. So it sits in this weird non-area. I mean, it hasn't got a category anymore, I don't think.
And when you look back at the corporate history, again, there's an interesting part that a lot of people write about where Billabong kind of expand more into like skatewear and streetwear and stuff like that. And you can almost extrapolate as to where that, you know, started going wrong for them. You know, they lost just this focus on this great brand image as being this really surfy brand and started to be everything counterculture, and it completely kind of blew up in their face in some ways.
Yeah, again, because they just became far too visible. And I think also they, in trying to sort of appeal to a very female kind of fashion market, they also really massively eroded their base. When you look at what like Quicksilver did when they started up Roxy. They started a, you know, a sub-brand, an affiliated brand that had a very tightly focused audience, very tightly focused market. So even though they kind of expanded, they were, you know, they spoke in different sort of visual graphic languages and different, you know, sort of tones of voice to their kind of young female audience. So like, this is our fashion label for young girls. Whereas Billabong's tried to sort of be all things to all people, whether you're a skater or a teenage, you know, teenage girl who's never been on a surfboard in your life, or a hardcore athlete, basically. Yeah. And I think they're just too broad now.
Mm. And then I think they tried to acquire it through buying the other brands that they brought, like NYX and Element, and that they just couldn't get there. They couldn't buy back their kind of authenticity.
Yeah.
And I think especially in surfing, you know, it's one of those cultures, you know, whether you like it or not, where authenticity is like the currency, you know, that overrides everything. So it's very fragile in the sense that once you lose that, you know, you're in trouble as a brand.
Yeah, I think, you know, you've got brands like FTW starting up, real grassroots surfer brands starting up again, and I think they kind of own the real kind of credible, authentic territory now. You've got brands like Saturdays,
yeah,
you know, who
fantastic.
Are in sort of really cool sort of, you know, urban surfing sensibility. You know, other people who are doing things much, much better.
Or Subi is the classic. That was like four surfer guys who started a label for their mates, and it's not a surf brand. But it started, you know, that must be 10 years old now.
Yeah.
And it's going from strength to strength. Mm. I mean, it's had some serious issues as well. And a good license challenge. But yeah, I think there's a danger in, I don't know how you make surf mass, or I don't think you can make surf mass. That would be my, I mean, they sponsor the hell out of all the best surfing comps around the world, the Billabong Pro. And I don't know what's going to happen to the Billabong Pro now. That's a real shame.
Mm.
And they've already had to pull out of the South African version of the Billabong Pro, take off the reward money Billabong have. So it's a tough one.
Sad story.
Yeah, actually. I know.
I really hope that's what they do, though. I really hope they go back to basics and massively strip back what they do, focus on their core products, do some sort of nostalgia products, that go back to the 70s.
You know, obviously, everyone's kind of talked about how this is the product of mismanagement. And one of my favourite comments that I heard today when we were talking about it upstairs is when I mentioned the brand Billabong to one of our editors, Sophie Grove. She said, oh my God, that brand is so 90s.
Mm.
And then we were saying, well, you know, there's been in some ways like a big 90s revival, and yet still Billabong couldn't cash in on that. They, you know, were still in this weird kind of mid zone, as you were saying, of, you know, not being in, you know, really nostalgic brand, or not being, you know, a cutting edge modern brand. They just couldn't fit it in either way.
Yeah. I'd love to see them go back and make, you know, sort of beautiful longboards and kind of do like a, you know, make maybe like a 70s collection, an 80s collection, 90s collection that goes back to their roots and that focuses on the actual surf gear. I would sort of, you know, let fashion take over for the time being, fashion and accessories and homewares and all of their other kind of, you know, subcategories, but really sort of focus on the boards and, you know, in a marketing sense, really strongly on the actual surfing competitions and talking to surfers again.
That surf-themed Aussie chinwag was chaired by our own associate business editor, Adrian Craddock, and he was talking to Claire Aitken from Wink Creative and to Emily Smith from Monocle.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And in the next half hour of the program, we look at countries that have succeeded in protecting their architectural heritage. Some countries are indeed better in this than others. But first, before all that, here's Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Phil. In the latest escalation of warnings from Pyongyang, North Korea has warned foreigners in South Korea to take evacuation measures in case of war. In other developments, Japan has deployed Patriot missile launchers in central Tokyo in a move officials said was aimed at providing ballistic missile defense in the event of a possible North Korean missile launch. And South Korea's largest news agency is reporting that North Korean laborers did not report for work at the Kaesong Industrial Park early today. Tributes are continuing to pour in for the former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, who died on Monday. News of her death featured prominently on the flagship newscasts of American broadcasters on Monday evening. The US Secretary of State John Kerry has held talks with the Israeli President Shimon Peres in Jerusalem.
They discussed the stalled peace negotiations with the Palestinian Authority and the threat that Iran poses to the region. President Obama has urged Americans to pile pressure on Congress to approve new gun control legislation that's at risk of falling victim to Washington gridlock. He took his gun control argument to the University of Hartford in Connecticut, an hour's drive from Newtown, the scene of December's school massacre. A scathing letter from John Lennon to Paul McCartney, a desperate letter from Marilyn Monroe, and a photo album from Mussolini to Hitler. They're among the items to be sold next month by a New York auction house. Lennon's letter, a draft which was never sent, is expected to sell for between $10,000 and $15,000. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Barney. Barney, we'll be back in about 26 minutes with another check of the world headlines. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds.
Yes, now protecting architectural heritage, I should say, is never an easy task, not easy to say either, but some countries seem to find it easier than others. Take Austria, for example, where strict laws combine with a widespread respect for history to preserve magnificent 18th century palaces and medieval churches. For this week's edition of Section D, Monocle's Alexei Korolev compares the country's success with his native Russia, where fairly feeble attempts to preserve listed sites are crushed by developers with ease and by wrong-headed officials.
European countries weren't always in love with their heritage. It was only in the 19th century that widespread awareness of architecture and culture began in Europe. Austrian Emperor Franz Josef I became a pioneer when he created a state commission for the protection of cultural heritage in 1850. More than a century and a half later, the commission's modern-day successor, the Bundesdenkmalamt, the Office for Federal Monuments, is as busy as ever.
We have in 1 year 30,000 answers to give to the people, yes. And this is really, really a lot to do.
Barbara Neubauer is the head of the office. She says most requests are for permission to carry out work or repairs on any of Austria's 37,000 listed sites.
And they have to come to us. And so if they don't come to us, they cannot rebuild something.
Hevig Frisch owns a historic 18th century house in Vienna's central Josefstadt district.
I and my family, we are the sixth generation here in this house, and we appreciate the old building. We moved in here after our marriage and our children grew up here, so they also like it very much, the old building and the thick walls and the old wooden windows and the high ceilings.
On the facade of the house, there are two plaques. One for Frisch's great-uncle and Nobel Prize-winning zoologist Karl von Frisch, and the other for 19th-century Swiss poet Gottfried Keller, who was also connected to the Frisch family.
So the house was also put under protection some 30 years ago or so, so that we must not change anything, which we actually do not want.
It is a sentiment which is shared by many in Austria. Well, there's been just one case of deliberate damage being caused to a historic site in the past 10 years. Partly for this reason, heritage crime is only punishable by small fines. But Bundesdenkmalamt head Barbara Neubauer says this should be changed as it might encourage further crime.
This is which makes us sometimes sad, because if somebody damage his or destroys his building, he only have to pay not a lot of money, and this is difficult, because people should know that they destroy really important things.
There is certainly a lack of this knowledge in Russia. Since the breakup of the Soviet Union in 1991, hundreds of historic buildings in Moscow and other cities have been bulldozed and blighted by greedy developers. Right now, they're claiming another victim, a central Moscow mansion which featured in Leo Tolstoy's iconic novel, War and Peace.
There is a very important term in the history of culture, the term genius of the place.
Dmitry Lisitsyn is a member of the Moscow-based heritage group Arkhnadzor.
Some places, maybe these buildings are not masterpieces of architecture, but they are really marked with the presence of some important historical figures.
Lisitsyn speaks as he stands in a one-man protest outside the house of the Bolkonsky Dukes, just a stone's throw from the Kremlin and Red Square.
So the genius of this place is a great Russian writer, Leo Tolstoy. This building was delisted 3 years ago for the interest of some private developers. What they're trying to do, they're trying to build a new building here. So this is a kind of renovation when original building just ceases away.
Works on the Bolkonsky House are being carried out despite a new urban policy initiative proclaimed by Moscow Mayor Sergei Sobyanin 2 years ago, which promised to put a stop to all construction in the city centre. The continuing demolition has prompted Arkhnadzor to launch a series of workshops to teach ordinary Muscovites how to protect the heritage. It's an attempt to teach the basics of conservation to a wider public. Nikita Brusilovsky is an archivist and lecturer in the workshops. The basic things are clear to all. It's bad to pull down a historic building, it's good to save it, but many people don't know the technicalities. These include details of heritage statuses or how to file a complaint with the authorities over an illegal development on a historic site. It's not on the curriculum, but Arkhnadzor also emphasizes the moral side. Dmitry Lisitsyn says developers will not be remembered for what they built, but for what they destroyed.
So people will remember them by these deeds. A lot of people will just say, "So, hey, this is a house which Mr. or Mrs. X demolished, and it is the house of old man Bolkonsky."
And it may not be just Moscow developers who aren't frightened by this prospect. Last year, a Russian businessman hit the headlines after having his 18th century French chateau demolished, seemingly by mistake.
Understandably, residents in a French village are upset after a demolition crew accidentally bulldozed the area's beloved 18th century chateau. However, a construction crew was hired to knock down another smaller building on the same grounds. But something went drastically wrong, as the building they were supposed to demolish is still standing. A former owner of the chateau states, "The whole village is in shock. How can this construction firm make such a mistake?"
Hervig Frisch in Vienna says he feels it is his duty to pass his house on to his descendants unchanged.
We feel somehow, how should I say, conservative. And I like the tradition and of course my family, and we got, so it's not my merit to live here and to get this house. So I inherited it from my parents and grandparents and grandparents. So, and I would like to preserve this value and conserve the spirit which lives in this house.
For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev.
And you can catch more design reports, including an interview with Japanese architect Toyo Ito and a snoop around New York studios of Scandinavian designer Soren Rose today at 1900 hours London time.
You're listening to Midori House. After this very short break, we get our man in Madrid on the line to give us the juiciest discussion topics from Spain.
The Entrepreneurs is a show about inspiring startups, innovative business models, and smart CEOs. It's about good ideas and the people with the business acumen to make them into the brands of tomorrow.
Character, your vision, your courage, all these are necessary to become a leader.
In the latest edition, we investigate the thriving startup scene in a place that was dangerous and gang-ridden just a decade ago, Medellin, Colombia.
One of the things we've been seeing a great deal of in Medellin is a migration of some really talented international entrepreneurs.
What characteristics make up the perfect CEO? We chat with one woman who's found the magic formula. We meet Garrett Camp, the man behind a seat-sharing service for private jets, and then head to the emerging Motown of southeastern Europe.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. The time is 15:42 in Shanghai, 9:42 in Madrid.
And that's exactly where we're going to head now. We're going to talk to Liam Aldous, who of course is Monocle's man in Madrid. Liam, how are you?
I'm great. How are you both?
Yeah, not too bad. Thank you very much, all things considered. Should we start talking about royal scandals? This has got a little bit deeper, a little bit more concerning for the king's son-in-law.
Yeah, well, not so much concerning for him anymore because he's set to take up a plum job in Qatar, even though he's embroiled in a massive fraud case where he's accused of embezzling millions of euros. Suddenly, he's going to go off to Qatar to become an assistant handball coach with one of his old friends. So it's quite interesting because he wasn't actually expected to hand in his passport, even though he's being investigated and is currently standing trial for this massive fraud case. So a lot of people are up in arms that he's set to just go on holiday, really.
And her husband, Princess Christine, his wife, Princess Christina, will be heading to court as well in the coming days.
Well, actually, she was set to go to court. This is another thing people are quite angry about. She was actually named and subpoenaed to appear in court last Wednesday, and people were finally happy that justice was going to be served, or at least the appearance of fairness in the judicial system was present. But then 2 days later, the Director of Public Prosecutions overruled the ruling, and she doesn't have to appear anymore. So it doesn't seem like the law is applied fairly to all, and everyone is quite unhappy. And the approval rating of the monarchy has actually plummeted. If you actually look at the polls last year, a poll was taken in December, and it was quite low, but since December, it's actually fallen 32 points, and the net approval rating of the king is at minus 11, which is not so good, and a lot of people are calling for his abdication. If you actually look at his approval rating amongst youngsters, amongst people under 34, it's minus 41, so it's not good times for the monarchy in Spain.
That is not a great figure at all. I suppose one solution to that is to have a bit of transparency, to sort of open up finances. I believe that's what's planned. How transparent is it really going to be?
Well, actually, the news was that the royal family have actually they volunteered to become part of the new transparency law, which is making its way through the passages of the Spanish government at the moment. It's taking its time, I must add, but they've actually said that they will open up their finances and show everyone what they're spending their money on, but the audits will only be internal. They won't be actually an external audit, so obviously questions arise about how transparent that actually is. And and going back to the royal family's approval ratings, actually the survey showed that tax inspectors are actually rated higher than the royal family at the moment. That's definitely worrying.
Not doing very well, are they? Some bad news for them. Is there a growing movement then in Spain to scrap the monarchy altogether?
It is definitely growing if you look at these approval ratings, but the king has actually been quite loved over the years. I mean, he played a very important role in foiling a coup after the move to democracy, and he has been quite loved. He was quite a good character, but after the string of corruption scandals and basically his handling of them, he hasn't been seen to really handle them well. His approval rating has fallen, so maybe his time is over. If he wants to kind of salvage his legacy, maybe this time he steps aside for his son, who's obviously valued a little higher.
Liam, one story that sort of made my jaw drop, I have to say, is that the government's announced that it's going to raise the legal age to be married, and it's raising it from 14, which seems extraordinarily young to me. I didn't quite realise that was where Spain currently stood on this.
Yeah, all those youngsters running off to the altar will have to wait a couple more years to the age of 16 now. They're going to raise the age limit, the age of consent, to 16. So I was quite surprised as well that it was 14. But if you look around Europe, I mean, Italy is also 14. The Vatican is actually 12 years old. You can get married at 12 in the Vatican. I don't know if there's too many youngsters living
scary
in the Vatican, but... So I mean, I think this was a kind of a tactic to kind of sway. I mean, while it's necessary, it's just perceived as a tactic to kind of sway the political narrative. There's lots of negative news around the government. So all the women in the cabinet were kind of wheeled out for this big, very public announcement that they were going to really buttress the rights of women, particularly because they're kind of seen as vulnerable when the age limit is quite low.
And what was the main push, the main driving force behind this change in the law? Was there a particular case or instance that really galvanized women's rights groups to push for this change?
No, not at all. So that's why a lot of people are perceiving that it was just literally a way to kind of sway the political narrative. And while it is seen as necessary, and there have been some moves by the health minister and some of the other ministers to kind of improve women's rights, it didn't really come out of anything, really. So it was kind of a surprise. I think it did kind of distract the political discussion for a day at least.
Liam, tell us about Los Escraches. They've targeted the vice president's home, but who or what are they?
Well, Escraches actually originated in Argentina and Uruguay. They're actually a peaceful demonstration which targeted politicians in their homes and workplaces to kind of publicly humiliate them when they were involved in corruption or human rights abuses. So it was a way of just basically swarming the homes or the doorsteps of these politicians to really bring attention to their involvement in something bad. But so basically in Spain, they're being used at the moment to kind of really sway the political discussion again about the eviction law, which is really unfair at the moment in Spain, is also being debated, and a lot of the ruling PP politicians are against actually changing the law, whereas the opposition is actually for changing the law. So these people have been swarming the doorsteps of the vice president, of the interior minister, and they're provoking a lot of controversy, particularly in the halls of government. And there was actually a headline today saying that there's a report being circulated to kind of criminalize the movement, which is not good news for them. But if you look at the public approval ratings of this movement, it actually stands at 78% of Spaniards actually approve of this political tactic. It seems the public is behind them, but the government is kind of fed up of having all these people yell at them every time they come out of their front door.
And Liam, just very quickly, I understand that our editor Andrew Tuck is heading down to Madrid on Thursday and Friday for some very special editions of The Briefing. Can you give us a quick sneak peek of what we can expect?
Well, it's going to be great. Andrew and I make a great team, I must add. But we're going to have a lot of really special guests, some surprise guests that will surprise a lot of our listeners. But we're going to be reporting from a entrepreneurship fair, which is like a festival. So we're talking a lot of young entrepreneurs, but also a lot of special guests, including the editor of El País. We may even have, this is exclusive, we may even have a player from Real Madrid that we're going to interview as well. So it's going to be an exciting couple of shows.
So lots to look forward to. That will be on Thursday and Friday editions of The Briefing at midday London time, 1300 in Madrid. That was Monocle's Man in Madrid, Liam Aldis. Thanks for joining us.
And we will continue with some Spanish music now. Tom Edwards is readying himself, clutching all of this morning's newspapers. He's going to run through the stories which have excited him in a couple of minutes' time. But we will have Back to the Future fans DeLorean first with Endless Sunset. Endless Sunset there by DeLorean.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. Now it's time for a check of today's front pages. Today we have the pleasure of having Monocle's news editor Tom Edwards in studio with us. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Phil. Good morning, Dom.
Thank you very much.
How are you both today?
Yeah.
Very well.
Top of the world.
We can only guess what's on the front pages of this morning's papers.
That's right. I mean, as our listeners, I'm sure, will well imagine, it's dominated by coverage of the death yesterday of Margaret Thatcher. I thought I'd do a couple of international pages just to get the sort of flavour of the coverage from around the world. The IHT, conservative of enduring imprint. With a strong will, she transformed Britain and modern capitalism. Fairly unequivocal,
yeah.
Reflecting the kind of enduring fascination that many on the right in the US.
Exactly. Well, she changed US politics to some notable degree as well, didn't
Absolutely.
She?
There's a lot of interesting testimony yesterday from people talking about this is the only overseas politician they could really imagine covering their passing in this way. But just to prove it's not all about the special relationship, El País in Spain has, something like 10 pages, all about my particular favourite. This is a picture they have, Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan with Lucky in the garden of the White House. And obviously reflecting, to a certain extent, her divisive characteristics. But La Revolucionaria de Hierro.
Yeah,
pretty unequivocal. And the portrait choice, again, a sort of a noble image.
Surprises me. There's a 10-page spread on her in El País. That's quite surprising, I think.
Well, it just reflects, in looking to the Australian Death of Britain's Iron Lady, perhaps in sort of English-speaking places, less surprising, but all around the world, absolutely dominated. And I think what sometimes people in Britain forget is that she was regarded as one of the most important international political figures of the latter half of the 20th century.
Well, sort of geographically, where Britain sat and sits, she was the sort of the middle bit of that triangle. She's Gorbachev was someone she could do business with, and she moved on from there.
Absolutely. She was fundamentally involved in so many of these key changes, not just sort of seismic economic and political changes. If you think about how the sort of almost the nature of capitalism changed in the 1980s, she was integral to that. Obviously, the collapse of the Soviet Union, she was integral to that political transition. And in terms of building that special relationship with the US, it was very important. But I thought if we just looked to the domestic papers here in the United Kingdom, we don't always do that, but I think it's interesting to see how they reflect this sort of divisive political legacy.
Indeed.
The Times has quite a nice portrait, a kind of wraparound cover, and they also have a sort of map inside, the long road from Grantham, of course, where she was born, winding up in the White House. But the piece that I thought was interesting is a piece by David Aronovich, the columnist. He's talking about how difficult it is to sort of continue to judge Thatcher, despite the fact that a lot of what she did almost work, but it was the way she did it that upset people. It would, though, have been so much easier if you could say it was wrong, Aronovich writes, but you couldn't. And she mentions the Falklands, to abolish closed shops, privatisation of certain nationalised industries. Even the IRA, he says, eventually gave up the fight, not because they'd won, but because they couldn't win. In all of these areas, Thatcher had been proved right. And I think that a lot of columnists have reflected that issue, that although she was very divisive, in some respects, you know, politically and economically, she was often right.
Indeed. Also, what startled me as a non-Brit, looking from it from the outside, is we all knew she was a very divisive figure, but you know, there was still, it was so palpable that division that still exists right after her death. You know, we saw people yesterday night celebrating popping champagne corks, on the street.
Street parties in Brixton. Indeed. I mean, I'm interested, Tom, how does the more left-leaning end of the media spectrum in the UK cover it?
Well, it's really interesting. The Guardian have a special kind of insert today, and they've chosen as their main picture a whole spread around the front of this supplement, a picture of Thatcher leaving Downing Street for the last time, with famously tears in her eyes, alongside Dennis in her car. And there was two interesting pieces I thought inside. One is about Songs of Rage. This was something that Robert Bound, our culture editor, talked about yesterday, about how Thatcher drove this almost an industry of resistance and an industry. You know, she gave a focal point for people to target their anger at. Ian Jack writes a piece explaining exactly why the anger lingers. He finishes by writing, "We can't blame or credit her for all of these problems, of course," talking about sort of emasculation of British industry, these kind of things. "But she personified the change from meaning to meaninglessness in so many settlements and lives. And for this reason, she's hard to forgive. Strident, divisive, and in her own view, infallible. And for these reasons, hard to mourn." And I think Ian Jack sums up quite well, certainly, what the more left-leaning elements of the press find very difficult about yesterday.
Yeah, it seems to be that. And also that she turned us into a nation, and indeed more widely in Europe and further afield, into individualists looking after ourselves without much concern for others. Tom, although I do have lots of concern for you, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for. It's coming up to the end of the show. That was Tom Edwards, our news editor. Today's show is produced by Mr. Marcus Hippi. Our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco and James Bullock too. Chris Fitch was the excellent studio manager. After the news, it's the Entrepreneurs. Then at midday London time, Monocle's design editor Hugo McDonald will be here hosting the briefing live from the heart of Milan. Phil and Emma will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. Bye-bye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.